The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
This is my favorite library. I love coming to the Free Library of Philadelphia. And I love talking to y'all. I know now everyone's going to open my book and look at the picture and say, that doesn't look like her, that doesn't look like her. It really is me. Want to thank Aurora. I want to thank Andy. I want to thank the library for always bringing me here, for being such an advocate for young people. And all people. And I think I'm going to start with, now that y'all are doubting, I'll start with locomotion. This whole book's a poem, because every time I try to tell the whole story, my mind goes, be quiet. Only it's not my mind's voice, it's Miss Edna's, over and over, be quiet. I'm not a loud kid, I swear, I'm just me. And maybe sometimes I make a little bit of noise. If I was a grown-up, maybe Miss Edna wouldn't be telling me to be quiet all the time, but I'm 11, and maybe 11's just noisy. Maybe 12's quieter. But when Miss Edna's voice comes on, the ideas in my head go out like a candle, and all you see left is this little string of smoke that disappears real quick before I have a chance to find out what it's trying to say. So this whole book's a poem, because poetry's short. And this whole book's a poem because Miss Marcus says, write it down before it leaves your brain. I tell about the string of smoke thing, and she says, good, Lonnie, write that. Not a whole lot of people be saying good Lonnie to me, so I write the string of smoke thing down real fast. And Miss Marcus says, we'll worry about those line breaks later. Write fast, Lonnie, Miss Marcus says. I'm thinking, I better write fast before Miss Edna's voice comes on and blows my candle idea out. And this is from... So that was from my book, Locomotion. This is from my book, Miracles Boys. Brothers is the baddest. Then comes Dominicans. Dominicans don't mess around. I'm cool with Dominicans, though. They don't mess with me. I don't mess with them. I lay back in my bed and listen to my brother New Charlie talking. For as long as I could remember, he'd been going on about who was the baddest. It used to be Puerto Ricans were... Puerto Ricans were usually at the top, but somewhere along the road, their status dropped. Brothers were usually at the top or the next ones down. New Charlie wasn't talking to me. Since he gotten back from Rahway Home for Boys a few months ago, he never talked to me. He was combing his hair back and talking to his boy, Aaron. They'd known each other forever to say what's up and stuff, but New Charlie and Aaron didn't start hanging tight till New Charlie got back from Rahway. Seems once New Charlie saw the inside of Rahway, all the brothers around here who hung out, cut school and hung out real late, thought he was some kind of wonderful, acted like New Charlie was their brother, acted like New Charlie was me. This is from the other side. That summer, the fence that stretched through our town seemed bigger. We lived in a yellow house on one side of it, and white people lived on the other. And Mama said, don't climb over that fence when you play. She said it wasn't safe. That summer, there was a girl who wore a pink sweater. Each morning, she climbed up on that fence and stared over at our side. She never sat up on that fence with anyone that girl didn't. Once when we were jumping rope, that girl asked if she could play. My friend Sandra said no without even asking the rest of us. I don't know what I would have said. Maybe yes, maybe no. And this is from behind you, Jeremiah. You do not die. Your soul steps out of your body, shakes itself hard because it's been carrying the weight of your heavy skin for 15 years. Then your soul lifts up and looks down at your body lying there, looks down at the blood running onto concrete, your eyes snapped open like the pages in some kid's forgotten picture book, your chest not moving. Your soul sees this and feels something beyond sadness, feels its whole self whispering further away. Shh. Past the trees in Central Park, past the statues and runners and children playing on swings, shh, over yellow taxicabs and late afternoon streetlights, shh, away from the dusting of snow, the white tips of trees, the darkening sky. Already you hear your mother screaming. Already you see your father dropping his head into his hands, helpless. Already you see your friends walking through the halls of Percy Academy, stunned. But you do not die. Each breath your soul takes is cool and reminds you of a taste you loved a long time ago, licorice, peppermint, rain. Then your soul is you all over again, only lighter and freer and able to be 1,000 places at once. Your new soul eyes look around, see two cops standing there. One cop curses and kicks a tree. Suddenly your soul realizes it's in the park. There are trees all around you and both cops look scared. He's dead. one cop says. And the other curses again. Your soul doesn't like the way the curse word sounds. Too hard, too heavy in the new soul light air. The cops can't see you. They see a young boy on the ground, a dead boy, a black boy. They know this is not the man they've been looking for. They know they've made a mistake. Your friends look at the boy and know his friends called him Maya, but his full name was Jeremiah Roseland. He is tall and dark. He has locks, and his locks are spread over the ground. His eyes are open wide, greenish-gray, lifeless eyes. Your soul looks at the boy and thinks, somebody loved that boy once, thinks, once that boy was me. The wind blows the snow left and right. You are so light you move with the wind and the snow. Let the weather take you. And it lifts you over a world of first kisses and over a world of anger and sadness and fear. Over a world of first kisses and hands touching and someone you're falling in love with. Look, right there. That's her. That's my Ellie. So for those of you who read Brown Girl Dreaming, you know that the way I learned to write was by writing the same things over and over, and that I was a really, really, really slow reader. And so in order to come to an understanding of reading, I had to read things again and again and again, and slowly the stuff began sinking in. And I'm still a really, really slow reader. So I've written 31 books now, and every book I've written again and again, and every book I write, I have to read it out loud because it has to sound a certain way as well as look a certain way on the page. So with all the writing and rewriting and the reading and rereading, I come to memorize a lot of it. And that last book I read from behind you, I mean, I recite it from, is the story of Jeremiah, who's 15. And it was the first book, If You Come Softly, was a retelling of Romeo and Juliet. So it was a love story, and I decided if I was going to make a love story in present day, what would the conflict be? So I decided to make Jeremiah black and Ellie, the girl who falls in love with him and who he falls in love with, white. And I knew because it was Romeo and Juliet that it had to be a tragedy, that somebody had to die. So first I killed off Ellie's mom, and that was corny. So then I brought her back and killed off Jeremiah's dad, because Jeremiah's dad had left his mom for this sister across the street, and I was mad at him. Even though I wrote the whole book and made up the whole story, I was still mad. And then that didn't work, so I resurrected him. And then finally, I wrote that book in 1995 or 1996. And the thing that was happening at that time, one thing I was seeing, were all these cases of police brutality and people getting killed in cases of mistaken identity. And I knew that if someone was going to die, that it was going to have to be Jeremiah. And so I was really not wanting to write the rest of the book, and really sad about it, because everything I write except Brown Girl Dreaming. Brown Girl Dreaming is a memoir, but the books that came before that were mostly fiction, and they weren't necessarily things that happened to me, but they were always emotionally autobiographical. So when I kill off a character, I have to feel this deep sadness, and I have to go back and remember something that made me really feel really sad so I could write that scene. And so, you know, I kept walking away from the book, and then I realized that I needed to write it. And a lot of people think that, people who don't know think that what's happening now with, you know, from Trayvon Martin to Eric Garner to all the brothers that are getting killed is something new, but it's been going on so long. And especially in the communities of color, we've always seen this happening. We've always known it to happen. And when I was a kid, my mom used to always tell my brothers never to run in a white neighborhood because you might get killed. And we never really understood that. And so when I was writing If You Come Softly, Jeremiah gets killed running in a white neighborhood. And so it's hard to stand up here with the riots going on in Baltimore and everything going on and not remember that we're all such a big part of this. This is affecting all of us. And a lot of the people marching are young people, and y'all are the ones who are going to change this. So I take my hat off to you. I know your teacher made you come here. I know y'all had to read my book. I know some of it was probably boring to you, and you're like, we don't care about that old black lady. What is she going to tell us that we don't already know? But you know what? I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad y'all are here. And now I'm going to read from Brown Girl Dreaming. Look like she's taking off her jacket. So those who've read the book know I've always wanted to be a writer. I grew up in a family where people didn't grow up to be writers. I had no idea how I was going to be a writer. It wasn't like now where you could come to a library and meet some writers, where you could go on the internet and see some writers talk about their writing. When I grew up, it was like, you know, all you had were paperback books and your library, and you would go there and you'd look at books and you'd try to copy the way the writer wrote and try to learn from other writers. And that's basically how you learn to write. You learn to write by reading. And you don't have to read fast. I don't read fast, but you have to read as an engaged reader. You have to read the same things again and again. You have to read slowly. You have to study how the writer writes stuff and learn from that. The Woodsons of Ohio. My father's family can trace their history back to Thomas Woodson of Chillicothe, said to be the first son of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Some say this isn't so, but the Woodsons of Ohio know what the Woodsons coming before them left behind in Bibles and stories and history coming down through time. So ask any Woodson why you can't go down the Woodson line without meeting doctors and lawyers and teachers, athletes and scholars and people in government, they'll say, we had a head start. Y'all don't have to read along with me. You don't have to find the page unless you really, really, really want to. And in that case, I'll tell you the page. But you could just experience me. You could just be read to. They'll say, we had a head start. They'll say, Thomas Woodson expected the best of us. They'll lean back, lace their fingers across their chest, smile a smile that's older than time, say, well, it all started back before Thomas Jefferson Woodson of Chillicothe. And they'll begin to tell our long, long story. How did I start writing Brown Girl Dreaming? So, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I have a 7-year-old son. And I wrote a book called Showway when my daughter was born, because my grandmother died a year before I got pregnant with my daughter. And I wanted to figure out how to connect them. And we were in the summer of 2009. It was Labor Day weekend, and we were on Sag Harbor, which is a place out on Long Island. And I got a call from my big brother that my mom had died. And my mom was 67, and she hadn't been sick, so she died suddenly. And when someone dies suddenly, first there's the shock. You don't believe they've died. And then there's the denial, so you pick up the phone, it's like, oh, I gotta call my mom, I gotta ask about, and then you remember. And I realized that I had all these questions I wanted to ask my mom that I couldn't ask her now, and that I hadn't asked her before. And one of the main things I wanted to know was, who was my mom before she became my mom, and how did I get here as a writer? You know, how did I end up writing all of these stories? So I just started writing down memory after memory after memory. And the reason the book is written in verse is because that's how memory comes to us, right? It doesn't come chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. It comes as these really short moments, and then there's all this white space, all this stuff you don't know about the moment. So I just started writing down all of these memories. And then when I didn't have... when I couldn't remember stuff, I decided to go back down south. So I went back to Greenville, where my mom's cousins, my second cousins and aunts, and I have a lot of relatives, and I just started asking them all questions about my mom as a little girl. And then they gave me a lot more memories. And then I came back home, and I wrote down a whole bunch of stuff. And then I decided to go interview my dad and my aunt. So my aunt is a genealogist, and they live in Columbus, Ohio still. So I went to Columbus, Ohio, and I interviewed the relatives there. And I interviewed my dad a lot. But in Brown Girl Dreaming, you don't meet my dad, right? You meet my dad when I'm first born, and then he and my mom separate when I'm 2 months old. So the question is, how do I have all this information about my dad, right? Because he was not in our lives for so long. When I was 13 years old, my mom and dad decided to get back together. And what a nightmare that was. But In so many ways, you know, my dad, for so long, I didn't know anything about him. My mom didn't like talking about him except to say what parts of me reminded her of him, and they were never good parts. So they got back together, and they stayed together for 4 years. And in that 4 years, I went to Columbus. I met my grandmother, Grace. My grandfather had died. I met aunts. I met cousins. I met the whole Woodson side that I wouldn't have known. And that's how I was able to get a lot of information. So this is Uncle Odell. 6 months before my big sister is born, my Uncle Odell is hit by a car while home in South Carolina on leave from the Navy. When the phone rang in the Nelsonville house, maybe my mother was out hanging laundry on the line or down in the kitchen speaking softly with her mother-in-law, Grace, missing her own mama back home. Maybe the car was packed and ready for the drive back to Columbus, the place my father called the big city, now their home. But every Saturday morning, they drove the hour to Nelsonville and stayed till Sunday night. Maybe right before the phone rang, tomorrow was just another day. But when the news of my uncle's dying traveled from the place he fell in South Carolina to the cold March morning in Ohio, my mother looked out into a gray day that would change her forever. "Your brother," my mother heard her own mother say. And then there was only a roaring in the air around her, a new pain where once there wasn't pain, a hollowness where only minutes before she had been whole. They don't have, so this is called Tobacco. And this poem, this memory is actually foreshadowing, right? How many, raise your hand if you finished the book. Okay, wow. Thank you for getting to the end of it. I know it's a long book. It's the longest book I've written. I usually write really short books because when I'm usually working on more than one book at a time, and then when I get bored with one, I go to the other one. And when I get bored with that, I go to the other one, and then I come back. But this one, I just stayed with, even though for so long I didn't think it was going to be any good. I didn't think anybody was ever going to read this book. I thought I was just going to put it in a drawer, and it was going to sit there. Anybody know what page Tobacco's on? 21? Are you making that up? You're so making that up. That's okay. I'll come back to it. This is called, I found it. It's on page 100. You would think a sister would memorize this, right? What pages? Sometimes I'll go look for a chapter or a part in a book, and I'll realize that it's not in there because I've rewritten it so many times I've edited it out. And I rewrote Brown Girl Dreaming 31 times before it's the book you see here. It took me 3.5 years. And then from the first edition to the second edition, I rewrote some of it again. But this is it. I'm not rewriting anymore. Summer is over, a kiss of chill in the southern air. We see the dim orange of my grandfather's cigarette as he makes his way down the darkening road. Hear his evening greetings and the coughing that follows them. Not enough breath left now to sing, so I sing for him in my head where only I can hear. Where will the wedding supper be? Way down yonder in a hollow tree. Mm-hmm. The old people used to say a pinch of dirt in the mouth can tell tobacco's story. What crops are ready for picking? What needs to be left to grow? What soil is rich enough for planting and the patches of land that need a year of rest? I do not know yet how sometimes the earth makes a promise it can never keep. Tobacco fields lay fallow, crops picked clean. My grandfather coughs again, and the earth waits for what and who it will get in return. Do y'all remember who it got? You could call it out. My grandfather. So that's the first poem where I'm talking about him dying. So I wrote a book called Visiting Day. So we moved from Ohio to Greenville to New York. And I wrote a book called Visiting Day, which was about a girl whose dad was in prison. When I was growing up, my uncle was in prison. and we were never allowed to talk about it. And we would always, you know, have to say he moved upstate. And I don't know, someplace in the 70s, 80s, there were a lot of brothers moving upstate. So, but when I wrote Visiting Day, I wanted to write a picture book for, so there's something like 2.5 million people who are incarcerated. So someone knows, has a brother or a sister or an aunt or an uncle or a mom or a dad or, so every, you know, you throw a rock and you know someone who's incarcerated, but people aren't allowed to talk about it. My grandmother, I never knew what kind of crime my uncle committed, but I knew that my grandmother would always say that doesn't matter. What matters is how much we love him. And so when I wrote Visiting Day, I didn't write about what my what the dad had done. I just wrote about the family going to visit him. And here, the same thing, when I decided to write about my uncle, I didn't know, because the people who knew what crimes he had committed had died. So this is called The Promised Land. When my uncle gets out of jail, he isn't my uncle anymore. He is Robert the Muslim and wears a small black kufi on his head. And even though we know we witnesses are the chosen ones, we listen to the stories he tells about a man named Muhammad and a holy place called Mecca and the strength of all black people. We sit in a circle around him, his hands moving slow through the air, his voice calmer and quieter than it was before he went away. When he pulls out a small rug to pray on, I kneel beside him, wanting to see his Mecca, wanting to know the place he calls the Promised Land. Look with your heart and your head, he tells me, his own head bowed. It's out there in front of you. You'll know it when you get there. And this is called Maybe Mecca. There is a teenager on our block with one arm missing. We call him Lefty, and he tells us he lost his arm in Vietnam. That's a war, he says. Y'all lucky to be too young to go. It doesn't hurt anymore, he tells us when we gather around him, but his eyes are sad eyes, and some days he walks around the whole block maybe 100 times without saying anything to anyone. When we call, hey, Lefty, he doesn't even look our way. Some evenings I kneel toward Mecca with my uncle. Maybe Mecca is the place Lefty goes to in his mind when the memory of losing his arm becomes too much. Maybe Mecca is good memories, presents and stories and poetry and arroz con pollo and family and friends. Maybe Mecca is the place everyone is looking for. It's out there in front of you, my uncle says. You'll know it when you get there. And now it's almost time for you to ask questions. I'm going to read one more poem, and then I'm going to talk about the rest of the writing through your questions. Is that cool? Sometimes. There is only one other house on our block where a father doesn't live. When somebody asks, the boy says, he died. The girl looks off down the block, her thumb slowly rising to her mouth. The boy says, I was a baby, says, she doesn't remember him, and points to his silent sister. Sometimes I lie about my father. He died, I say, in a car wreck, or he fell off a roof, or maybe he's coming soon, next week, and next week, and next week. But if my sister's nearby, she shakes her head, says, she's making up stories again, says, we don't have a father anymore, says, our grandfather's our father now, says, sometimes that's the way things happen. So questions. Say it again. Do I still talk to my dad? I saw my dad, Jack, on Saturday. He lives in Ohio. He still lives in Columbus. And I was in Columbus reading at a library, and he came to the reading, and then we went out to dinner. But yeah, he's, you know, my mom died, my grandmother died, my grandfather died. So he's one of my closest living relatives. And he's tall. You know, I'm the shortest in my family, and I'm 5'10". And, so my dad's 6'3", my mom was 6'1", my sister's 6 feet, my brothers are both 6'3". But, so the thing is, I know, I always, I thought I was going to either be a writer or a basketball player. I wanted to play for the Knicks, but, so writing felt, when you compare it to that, writing felt quite realistic to me. What's your name?
I'm Solomon.
Say it again.
Solomon.
Solomon.
Yeah. Was it hard to remember the events you wrote in your book?
That's a good question. Was it hard to remember them? You know, it's interesting because we think we've forgotten stuff. And once I started writing down memories, the more I wrote, the more stuff came. And I can't tell you guys enough how important it is to ask the people, the grown-ups and the old people in your life, to tell you their stories. And sometimes they won't. Sometimes the stories are too painful for them. But, you know, once they're gone, we don't have those stories anymore. But it was definitely when I started getting stuck, that's when I decided to go back down south into Ohio to get everybody else's stories. And that helped me, too, to remember some of them. Thanks, Solomon.
How did it feel to feel?
What's your name?
Deja,
okay.
How did it feel to be halfway home everywhere you lived?
It's a good question. How did it feel to be halfway home everywhere I lived? I think there was always a longing, right? There was always like the grass is always greener on the other side. And but I think if I didn't have that feeling, I wouldn't be a writer. You know, because I lived different places and because I had so many people in my life and so many different events, I was able to tell lots and lots of different stories from lots of different points of view.
Have you ever felt home?
I feel home in Brooklyn. I love Brooklyn. And, you know, but still with my family, we travel a lot. And I think one of the other things about not feeling super, super connected to someone is that you're not afraid, someplace, you're not afraid to leave it.
What was one memory that was important to you but had forgotten?
I think one memory that was important that I had forgotten, I think the thing I didn't think so much about, even though it was very, I hadn't forgotten it, but it just was my brother and how we had to leave him in the hospital because he had lead poisoning. And the more I started writing about that period and all the stuff that happened during that time, the more that memory came more clear to me.
How did you feel when it came back to you?
When the memory came back to me, I felt really excited because I had more stuff to write down. And with each thing I wrote down, it allowed for there to be a completeness to it. I felt like, okay, that story's told. I can put it to rest now. And also, you know, because I was writing about my family, I had to ask my sister and my brothers if it was okay to share the information, because here it was going to go out into the world. So they read everything I wrote that was about them. And, of course, my sister loves the book. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tell me your name again.
Felicity.
Okay, Felicity. Thank you.
I'm Avery.
Hey, Avery.
Hi. So I noticed that you had your family tree in the beginning of the book. And it went back to the 1900s. So how did you get that information?
Oh, how did I get the information from my family tree? From my Aunt Ada, who's the genealogist. So she has us all the way back to 1832. Hmm. So, yeah, she has all the... one thing that I discovered from her, so she has the census, the actual census. So people's name, you know, when they take the census, they would just send people around to collect the information. So there's census where... everybody's name is always spelled differently because people would just spell it how they thought it sounds. So like for my grandfather, there's G-A-N-N-E-R, there's G-U-N-N-A-R, there's G-A-N-N-A-R. So there's all these different spellings for Gunnar. And then the ages would be different. And then we'd find out stuff because on one, a sibling, the person would have 13 kids. And then the next year there would only be 10 kids. And we knew that some of the kids had died. So it was really interesting just looking at those handwritten histories. And now it's all computerized, but it wasn't. Thanks, Avery.
All right, I'm Sarah. How did you start writing Tupac and Dee Foster?
Oh, how did I, that's a good question. How did I start writing after Tupac and Dee Foster? The first character in my head was actually Desiree, was actually Dee Foster. And I knew that she wasn't going to tell the story because even, I never outline when I write. I never know where a story's going. I never know how it's going to get there. But I heard her voice in my head. And I afraid, you know, y'all ever think about your big purpose and her having this whole idea about a bigger purpose. And so I just started writing that down, and I had always loved Tupac. And when I listen, when I'm writing a book, I usually listen to music when I'm writing. And depending on the book, that determines what kind of music. So for the year and a half that I wrote that book, all I was listening to was Tupac, and researching Tupac's history. So everything in that book about Tupac is true. And then I decided I was going to have three girls be obsessed with him. And so when I wrote it, I kept trying. I knew Dee Foster wasn't going to tell the story. I knew the narrator was going to tell the story. And I kept trying to figure out, what's her name? What's her name? What's her name? And I would insert these names, and they felt corny. And then I'd try another name. And then by the middle of the book, I figured out why I couldn't, why I didn't know her name. So that was cool, because sometimes through writing you discover stuff, and I discovered that. Do you remember her name?
I didn't read it.
Oh, you didn't read it? Come back. You can email me when you do. So there's a reason. There's something very particular about her name. So thank you. Thanks, Sarah.
Hi, my name is Sana, and I want to start off by saying I thought your book was wonderful.
Thanks, Sana.
So you mentioned how you wondered about who your mother was before she was your mother. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you wrote the book Brown Girl Dreaming for your daughter and for your son, because one day they might wonder who you were before you were their mother.
That's a good question. Did I write it for Toshi and Jackson Leroy? You know, the funny thing is, I think I did. I think everything I write now, I think about them and how they'll feel about it. But that said, my kids will not touch my books with a 10-foot pole. So, and it was so funny because my daughter was on her school bus, and she loves telling this story. And her friend had her phone, and her friend was like, and I was texting her to try to find out something. Her friend's like, "You got a text from Jacqueline Woodson. You know Jacqueline Woodson?" And I'm like, "Really? It's like that? You're that down low about me?" So I think eventually they're going to come back to the books and understand parts of me. But I think right now they think, "You just talk so much. We know everything we want to know." But there's this, I don't know if you know this book. It's a picture. It's a kid's picture book called Big Red Lollipop. And one of the main characters is Sana, and it's about this family that comes. This is their first year in the country, and the girl gets invited to a birthday party, and her mother makes her take her little sister, and she's like, "Nobody does that here." And it's a great book, so look it up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Brenda Kui. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
My question is today: it's like in the back of the book, you said like you went back home, and then like you saw how you kind of felt lonely, like walking through home without your family. How did you kind of feel then? Like, did you regret not being able to walk with them, or?
So in the back of the book, I talk about going back to Greenville, where I had spent so much of my childhood, and walking those same roads that I had walked with my uncle, with my grandfather, with my grandmother, with my mother, and none of them were alive to walk those roads with. It was very bittersweet. I mean, one thing that was amazing was how clearly I had remembered it. One thing that was also interesting is the house we lived in, which I had remembered as a big house, was not big at all. My grandmother's house in Greenville. It was that longing that even for like Maria, my best friend Maria, who still really, really close, when I go back to Madison Street, like all the memories of us as kids on Madison Street comes up, and it's like that longing of wanting to go back to that period. But I definitely, you know, thought, you know, in my next life, I'm going to be so much more present with the people close to me. But yeah, it was definitely that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Maria, and I was wondering, like, did you have any hesitations, like, pulling your feelings and your life experience out there for, like, the whole world to see?
Did I have any hesitations about putting my life and experiences out there? You know, I think that's one of the things that keeps people from writing. And whenever I start writing, I say, no one is ever going to read this. And that really frees me up to write what I'm going to write. And reading it out loud really helps me feel safe about having it in the world. And I think the great thing about it is the more specific you are and the more you put out there, the more friends you make, because you realize people have common experiences. I just got an email. I'm going to see if I see it from... This was like one of those moments that you know you're doing the right thing. But this guy wrote me, and here it just John Men. I just finished your book last week. As a mid-40s Asian-American upper-middle-class husband and father of two, I have absolutely nothing in common with you. However, the hope and discovery that emerged through the trials you faced was inspiring. So here's someone who doesn't know me from a can of paint, yet he can come to the book and read that and think about his own life. And I think that's what writing does. So even though I do sometimes think, ugh, what is the world going to think about me when they read this, I kind of have to push past that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I love your book, and...
Thank you. What's your name?
Therese.
Say it again.
Therese.
Therese.
And I was asking, when did you realize that you wanted to become an author?
Well, I've known I wanted to be an author since I was 7. And, you know, that poem when I talk about writing the letter J and realizing that letters make words and words make sentences, like, that was so powerful and amazing to me. And that's when I knew I wanted to be an author. My family was really nervous because they're like, how are you ever going to make a living? But I knew that no matter what I did, I was going to write. I didn't know if I was ever going to publish anything, but I knew I loved writing. And I had a teacher who said, when you choose a career, choose something you love doing because you're going to be doing it for the rest of your life. And writing was the only thing I could imagine doing for the rest of my life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ja'Kai Lewis, and I just want to know what inspired you most to write this book and how did it impact you?
The thing that inspired me the most to write it was my mom's death. And then really, after writing so many books and, you know, getting so much recognition, trying to understand how I got here and to understand, you know, because when you read the book and you see kind of all the stuff that seems to have been against me, right? I came from a working class poor family. I was part of the Great Migration. My mom was a single mom. We were Jehovah's Witnesses, and then we were Jehovah's Witnesses and Muslim. Like, all of that stuff, if anything, you don't expect that person to be a writer. But then, of course, when you think about it, of course she would be. So I think that was one of the main things, was like trying to get a sense of myself as a young person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lila Corgan, and Sana already touched on this question a little bit, but I'm wondering if you had an audience in mind when you were writing this, and particularly who your audience for How to Listen was and is. I'm asking this because I read your book in the context of just learning about the Eric Garner case and Tamir Rice, and I was grateful that I was reading this book throughout that, because I imagined and continue to imagine that you're giving advice on giving advice to people who are not of color on how to listen.
Huh. You know, if that's what people who are not of color need, then that's what I'm doing. You know, I think in the How to Listen are actually haiku about how to become a writer. You know, so though each one is how I learned to write, and it does come back to the question, because it is also about the way you can write is, the thing you need to write is empathy, and that's what we all need, right? So you, once, if you have empathy, you can tell stories, and each haiku is like, you know, even the silence has a story to tell you. Just listen, like how important it is to kind of be in the moment and pay attention to the world around you and how that world impacts you. So I guess it's both those things. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Patrice. You kind of already answered my question, but I want to know what you were thinking of when you wrote How to Listen, number 8.
Which one is that? Read it, Patrice.
Do you remember someone's always asking and someone always does?
So that was the How to Listen. That's another one. Writing is about memory, right? You take, and it's about connection. So do you remember that time we did blah, blah, blah? Do you remember when she said blah, blah? You know, it's always that connection that two people have around memory. And it's another lesson in how we get story.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, my name's Nicholas, and I was wondering, how has your sexual orientation affected or influenced your writing?
How has being queer influenced my writing? I think, you know, it's so interesting. I write realistic fiction, and I write books for people who have historically not been represented in the world. And so in the world, we have black people, we have white people, we have wealthy people, we have poor people, we have straight people, we have queer people, we have trans people, we have people in wheelchairs, we have people on canes, we have people who wear wigs, we have people who don't, we have single moms. And until all of those people have mirrors of themselves in literature, my work is not done. And I think more than it just being about sexual orientation, it's about being of color, it's about being a woman, and it's about having a consciousness of a greater good and a bigger world. And, you know, it was funny because I got a call from many years ago from Judy Blume, and she was putting together an anthology called The Places That I Had Never Meant to Be, and she said it was an anthology on censorship. And she wanted me to be in it. And I'm like, I've never been censored. She's like, oh, yes, you have. And I didn't even know that. But I think, you know, it was Audre Lorde who said, you know, our silence won't protect us, that we can sit in our corners mute as bottles and we'll still be no less afraid. And I think that it's really important that that people feel safe in the world. And so for me, writing is about creating a world in which I feel safe to walk through, which I feel like I can run anywhere in and not get shot, you know, which I feel like my son and my daughter and the people, you know, all over can just walk through the world unafraid. And so that's how writing has affected me, and that's how, and I think that goes into my writing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nicholas.
I was wondering, I was looking in the back of the book, and your Aunt Kay, her picture wasn't in there. I was wondering why.
My Aunt Kay is in there. She's Carlene. So Aunt Kay, we called her Kay. She's right there with my mom. So if you look at the Irby side, she's right below my daddy. It says Aunt Carlene, and then it says in parentheses Kay on page 336.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I almost had a moment of panic. I'm like, did I leave Kay out? Yeah, that's her. She and my mom look a lot alike. Any other questions? So I think I'm going to just end with the I Believe poem. Actually, I'm going to end with Each World. When there are many worlds, you can choose the one you walk into each day. You can imagine yourself brilliant as your sister, slower moving, quiet, and thoughtful as your older brother, are filled up with the hiccuping joy and laughter of the baby of the family. You can imagine yourself a mother now, climbing onto a bus at nightfall, turning to wave goodbye to your children, watching the world of South Carolina disappear behind you. When there are many worlds, love can wrap itself around you, say, don't cry, say, you're as good as anyone. Say, keep remembering me. And you know, even as the world explodes around you, that you are loved. Each day a new world opens itself up to you, and all the worlds you are, Ohio and Greenville, Woodson and Irby, Gennar's child and Jack's daughter, Jehovah's Witness and non-believer, listener and writer, Jackie and Jacqueline, gather into one world called you, where you decide what each world and each story and each ending will finally be. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.